Hey, this is Jeff Seymour, and welcome to the podcast. I'm back. I'll explain. So I've been off the airwaves for a while. Those of you that have been studying with me or following my social media accounts probably know that I scored a big gig. But for those of you that aren't aware, I'll quickly bring you up to speed and let you know what's happening, because I plan on using this job that I've acquired as a stepping off point for whatever ideas, reflections, things I'm learning as I move along. So I've been given this great opportunity to be in a play here in New York City at the Manhattan Theater Club, a favorite theater of mine that I've only known from afar because I've never worked in theater in New York City. I'm going to be in the world premiere of Prayer for the French Republic, written by Joshua Harmon and directed by David Cromer. So let me give you some background on the story, because the first part of this, I think, speaks to the idea of, you know, it's never over until it's over. I really hadn't had a big job in 3 years. Well, last job I had, I don't know what it was, but I've been living in L.A. You know, COVID happened. A lot of people didn't get the chance to do much work, myself included. I was working more, it seemed, in Canada than in the States, but without being really able to travel into Canada and, you know, deal with all of the situation that was happening during COVID, I just kind of put that aspect of my career on hold, figuring that someday when the smoke clears, I'd find some work in the United States. Luckily, I'm gainfully employed with, you know, my teaching and enjoying myself puttering around and restoring old cars, as some of you know I like to do. So one day, in March of last year, actually, I got an email that I happened to find in my spam, and it was from the Manhattan Theater Club. And one of the casting directors there sent me a note saying she'd been trying to track me down. Now, I don't know if I'm somebody you try and track down. I immediately thought she must be confusing me with a movie star. And after looking into it with a friend of mine in New York City, he told me immediately, no, this is a big deal. And so I threw my hat in the ring. And I won't bore you with the details, but it took 7 months before I finally was told that I got the role playing Charles, the father, in this incredible play. So then relocation to New York City, renting my place in L.A., finding a place to rent. Luckily, I found a place here in Chelsea, and I've been in rehearsals since December 1st. This is the first play I've ever been in my life that I didn't direct and produce. I used to run a theater, as some of you know. I built my own theater and had that for 10 years from 83 to 93. And I've done shows outside of that theater, of course, that I would rent a place and produce and direct. Many of you know that I don't like theater, and I really didn't try and audition for other people's theater because I just find theater to be fakey most of the time. I was assured, and it was easy to find out looking into David Cromer's past, that this guy had an aesthetic that, I would totally be compatible with. So obviously I jumped at the chance, and here I am. So the first part of this, it's never over until it's over. I had just lost the talent agency that I had here in the United States 2 weeks prior to getting this message from the casting director at the Manhattan Theater Club. I come to find out that, in fact, when they couldn't find what they wanted, because the person had to be of a particular look, a Middle Eastern look, there were certain parameters that they were trying to meet, and lucky me, they couldn't quite find it in New York City. I found out from this casting director that when she went on some website looking up Middle Eastern actors who spoke a Middle Eastern language and my face popped up, she was able to figure out who my last agency was, contacted them, and said, hey, you know, I'm trying to get a hold of Jeff Seymour. And, you know, they dropped me 2 weeks before, so they weren't interested in letting her know anything. And then she almost dropped it, figuring, well, that's that. I can't find him. Then she decided she'd make one last try, go onto the internet, and thank goodness, you know, because of my teaching and my past experience, I'm easily found on the internet. She sent me an email that ended up in my spam, and here we are. You know, it's never over until it's over. But let me tell you what got me ready for the moment when, after 3 years, I had a chance to audition a number of things. One, thankfully, my classes. I mean, even though I'm not really participating as an actor in those classes, there's just something about being in the dojo, well, 8 times a week, that was just keeping me sharp. I mean, it made me feel like I was doing it all the time, and I was, because I've said it before on these podcasts, I feel that I've learned so much. I always learn so much. Dealing with actors, redirecting actors, you know, elaborating on a concept, an idea. So I'm grateful for that. Also, knowing it isn't over till it's over, because I didn't feel daunted when I got the email, like, oh my goodness, I'm rusty. How will I ever, you know, I haven't worked in 3 years. I'm useless. No, I guess I had planned and hoped that an opportunity would come along sooner or later and I'd be able to take advantage of it. And it worked out. So I was ready, and so here I am in New York. Man, you know, that's the beauty of this business. You can be sitting here wondering how you're going to make rent next month, and in a week from now you're on a series. I mean, it happens. I know it's a little bit like the lottery, and you don't want to count on winning lottery tickets, but it does happen. And, well, it just happened with me, and I am so grateful. And so, rehearsals. Many people wondered, you know, knowing that I have been a director my whole life, and, you know, I have my beliefs. Obviously, I do the podcast. I've written a book. I've been a teacher, you know, and directed many plays. How it would be me taking direction from, you know, a director. Okay, well, simple. Why? Because having been a director my whole life you know, dealt with actors my whole life, I understand the etiquette. And I've said it here many times. We are essentially, as actors, musicians in the orchestra, and the director is the conductor. It's not for me to argue how my piccolo should be played. If I trust the director, I'm trusting that they are trying to conduct a certain sound, a certain music, a certain story, and with all of our help, we are trying to come to that. But I have to trust the director. I have to allow the director to do whatever he or she sees fit. And so my job is to sit there like the dutiful musician, listening to exactly what my conductor wants, and then do my best, playing my own instrument the way that I play it, which is probably the reason I was hired for the job, but with the end result of what they're looking for in their particular story. And so to that end, it's an easy job. I just do what the director asks. If I'm unclear, I ask questions. But you know, this particular director is incredibly clear. And so it's been easy for me. So during the course of my time here in New York and on the play, I will use that as a jumping off spot to discuss various things that I have found to be occurring, observations I'm making, things I'm learning, as a way to inspire ideas and things that, you know, I can talk to you about. One thing that comes to mind is, having heard so much about David Cromer, some of you may know, he's the one who directed The Band's Visit, which won 10 Tony Awards, including one for himself. And, you know, coming into it, I'd heard so much about how he is. And yes, I had friends that knew of his work saying his aesthetic's the same, you know, you'll like the way he talks. And I do. It's interesting, you know, what makes a great director? Because there is nothing flamboyant, large, loud, aggressive about David Cromer. He's a very smart man who is incredibly humble, but he has many attributes that I think, aside from just an innate skill to be able to tell a story in a way that's obviously compelling and audiences like, the way that he handles actors. So for those of you who wonder what that might be, or who are perhaps looking into, you know, being a director, let me share with you some of my observations. He's incredibly respectful. If you're talking and he thinks you're finished, but you happen to utter another word, he will immediately stop what he's doing and say, I'm sorry, were you finished? And he doesn't say it in a snarky way. He means it. And if you start to talk just by some chance and he hasn't finished, he'll immediately interrupt what he's doing to say, what were you going to say? And for the person running the show to be able to always be this patient is incredible, because it makes the actors certainly feel like they're a part of it, but it instills a certain confidence, you know, because he is able to very graciously, very gracefully allow you to feel like you are definitely a part of it all, you see. He never micromanages. He tries to inspire you with intelligent thought or, you know, observation into your performance. He knows that we are all trying to find our way, himself included. He's always making sure that he's leaving open what could then happen next, or, you know, what we will find out. Nothing ever seems like it's set in stone at the very top. You know, especially with a world premiere, a piece that's never been done in front of an audience. He is completely aware of the fact that, you know, we are all trying to find our way. And this all lends itself to a real feeling that we're in this together, and it affords the actors a certain amount of respect that I think helps to instill that confidence and get us to then always do our best without feeling like we'll be overly criticized, or if we make a mistake, you know, we'll feel foolish. Never at all, ever. Granted, in a theater experience, we're afforded a rehearsal period, so there's more time. But one of my observations is, if he is kind of going after a moment in a particular way that he wants it to go, or, you know, a certain feeling or flavor he'd like it to have, I've noticed that if it doesn't change, or if it isn't quite it, and now granted, I'm just trying to figure out what I think he's after, and I think I get an idea, and then I watch the actors, and maybe they don't quite get to it after two or three kicks at the can. He doesn't belabor it. He leaves it and moves on, and then, you know, he'll circle back on another rehearsal. And what I've found, having left the room at times to go off and look at all my lines and try and, you know, take the time when I'm not on stage to study, I'd come back and realize all of those things had gotten to where he wanted it to be. So the lesson there is, when you try, and you have the time, of course, when you try to get to a certain thing, you don't need to overwork it to the point that the actors get a little rubbery in their head, feeling like, well, why does he keep asking me to do it over and over and over again, you see? Because you can get to diminishing returns. And I've seen that what he will do is, if it doesn't happen immediately, he'll leave it alone. Sometimes the actors will come back the next time and actually incorporate the note without having to be told again. And then they nail it. Or he'll hit it a different way the next time he comes to it, with different language, and there he arrives at it. There is a finesse that certainly is perhaps a little more afforded when you're working in theater and you have rehearsal time, that he uses to great results. So what does that mean? That means that, you know, if you're directing something and you have the time, as I keep saying, and you're going to know that you can come back to this moment, don't feel this insecure need to make it right then. And a lot of directors will do that because they feel like, no, they're not doing what I'm saying. And I need everyone to know what I'm saying, because if I accept this moment as they're rendering, it's not quite what I want. And I don't want everyone watching to think that this is what I'm saying. I'm saying something else. You see, the fact that he's so secure and he has such confidence that he can think, well, we'll come back to it. It's not a big deal. Because the same people that are watching this rehearsal will watch that other rehearsal. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. What is the best way? And he's always trying to look for that in the people that he's working with, something that I, of course, completely agree with. Another observation I've made that has to do with interpreting a script. You know, I've always said that the actors and director, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to text, when it comes to the script, the written word, that our duty is to, first of all, say every word that's on the page as it's been written, unless we have permission to change it. And then secondly, and certainly, it is to try and interpret the story in the spirit that we certainly would imagine, if we can't talk to the writer, but if we can, in a spirit that is what the writer intended. It's their story, and we want to try and respect that and deliver it up in that vein. Where I've said the actor never needs to feel compelled to do what's written on the page is in regard to stage direction. For me, and having been someone who's written, when you add stage direction, you're trying to create the picture, perhaps help fill it in, give you a sense of, you know, how this might go or how it might feel. So you put in certain movements, you know, he glares at him, a pause, whatever. This writer has been brilliant in not doing any direction like that. The only direction that he does put in will be pauses, a beat, a long beat, a very long beat, you know, things like that, to give you a sense of timing or how that moment should be framed, you know, because moments do get framed on a stage if there is silence before or after it. It sets it off. The audience now pays attention to this next moment, and it gives it a certain framing. What I've noticed is that while he puts those in, I see how diligently the actors and the director try and abide by them. There is no if, ands, or buts about that. We all try to. We see it there. It says a long beat, a short beat, whatever. And, you know, this is a fellow who really knows how to write. And, you know, he's got the credentials and awards to prove it. And so we all respect that. But then there comes a moment when, you know, it just doesn't work for whatever reason. And I'm going to tell you why that is. You read in a script, someone says something, and then it says a long beat. Well, okay, I don't know, you know, how long is a long beat? But, you know, we imagine it's longer than short. And then the next person speaks. The thing is, you can read a moment like that, and without seeing it, without having people act it out, without actually hearing that pause, in your mind, it won't be, generally, it's never wrong, because your mind will go to that next line anyway. You don't sit there and pause. You read the next line. And how long a pause before you read the line? Well, you probably read long beat, and then you read the next line. Between those two lines in your head, you know, there wasn't a long beat. And if there was supposed to be, and even though you read the next line, you would still see it right. But here's the thing. When you have live people doing it, it's very different. It's very different, depending on the day, the people, the way they did the line, how loud, how fast, when the next person comes in exactly. And we have found sometimes these long beats or short beats after, you know, trial and error, they just don't work in the way they maybe were set on the page. So what does that mean? Well, that means that we need to do then what makes it work. And certainly the writer never has a problem with it, particularly when the writer sees us trying to make the other one work. And then the director says, or an actor decides to come in sooner or later, whatever. That's how it goes. Because at the end of the day, something as simple as a long beat isn't literary. It's a direction. It is telling the orchestra how long to wait before someone starts playing next. And the truth is, until you hear the music playing, you don't really know what works. And I would even argue that depending on the actor, depending on the intensity of that moment, a different timing might be better. This is something that the director senses, but certainly any actor worth their salt would know when they're working live in front of an audience exactly how long to take. You can feel it. So that is a thing certainly for you writers out there and directors to consider. What we're actually beholden to, every word as written, the spirit of the piece, the story that is the intention of the writer that we should tell with all respect. But the bits of stage direction, at the end of the day, need to be left up to the director and actors. Because when something's live, it's very different than written. But luckily, once again, these incredibly talented people all know that, and it's never an issue. It's never a problem. Stage directions like that are generally offered up as an indication, an idea, a flavor. But you don't have to follow them like it is a, you know, set in stone roadmap. So now, on this day, January 3rd, 2022, our schedule just changed from being in a rehearsal room at a different location to the actual theater space, which is going to be very interesting. The set is something I can't wait to see because it is actually based on a 36-foot in diameter turntable with these beautiful set designs that I've seen renderings of and models of, but today I'll get to experience. I'll also get to meet my understudy. I don't even know who he is or what he looks like. I imagine something somewhat like me. And now is when we do tech, because we've got to take all of that rehearsing and now start to figure out how we get on and off and lighting and everything else. And we start our first preview January 11th, which is coming up real soon. So we get to do previews until February 1st. And so we'll have we do 8 shows a week. I think we'll have around 24 previews. So I'm imagining we're going to sort this out and figure out what needs to be done before opening night. The only variable out there right now, as you may know, is COVID. We get tested 3 times a week, and if we show up with a positive, we get benched for 10 days. Regardless of whether you're showing symptoms or not, those are the rules. So we're all in the set, just going straight home. We're not socializing. We're not going out. You know, I suppose if it comes for you, it's going to find you wherever. But we wear masks in every rehearsal, while we're rehearsing. We don't get to take our mask off until preview night, from what I understand. And as horrible as that sounds, I have to say, we've gotten quite used to it. You know, we act with our mask on. We all want to stay here. We've lost the writer to a 10-day benching because he had a positive, even though he's asymptomatic. And we lost a stage manager for the same reason. So, you know, it's hitting real close, and every day we go in, we have to, when we take the test, you know, we're all, I suppose, a little nervous, but my philosophy is you do the best you can, and, you know, you're going to get dealt the cards you do, and then you try and play them. So we'll see what happens. But I'll be returning with other thoughts now as we get into tech, to previews, to what's going on, and any other experiences that will inspire something I can offer you guys now that I'm in this real life situation of working that's, you know, going to be over an extended length of time with many moving parts. Hey, it's great to be back. By the way, my Zoom classes have now, you know, really been scaled down, obviously, because of my schedule. But it looks like I'll have Mondays off. And on Monday, I'll do probably two classes for the different time zones. You know, I'll figure that out. I won't be able to take as many people, obviously. But those of you that really want to and feel like you're going to be in it every week, I will take those people on and we'll continue to have our Zoom fun. I hope you're all doing well. Hang in, man. Listen, my life just changed and it came out of nowhere. So, you know, fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you. Be well, and I hope you all have a great 2022, and I will be talking to you soon. Thanks for listening. You have been listening to a Real Life Actor podcast. This is Jeff Seymour. Real Life Actor podcasts can be found on a variety of platforms, including Pandora, Spotify, Podomatic, iTunes, Verbal, and many more. Please tell your friends. And if you like what you've been hearing, please remember to hit the like button and subscribe. You'll be the first to know when the next one comes out. And if you haven't read my book, The Real Life Actor, you can find it on Amazon in paperback and Kindle. Thanks so much for listening.